Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight, where Valerie Lawson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. This is the third occasion on which she's spoken for us. As you know, Valerie Lawson is a journalist and author who was with Fairfax for around three decades, but her books are on Connie's Sweetheart, then The Ellen's Affair, for which she spoke for us, Mary Poppins, she wrote, the biography of Pamela Travers, and Now, for which Ms. Lawson also spoke to us, and Now, Dancing Under the Southern Skies, A History of Ballet in Australia, which has recently come out. So, tonight, Valerie Lawson is going to speak for the Sydney Institute on the topic Behind the Red Velvet Curtain, the backstage story of ballet in Australia. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. It's good to see you here. Some balletomanes I know, some not. Look, the first article I ever wrote about ballet, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah. It was in 1999 when I was a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald. And at that time, Margot Fonteyn had just died that particular month. And I was, like, heartbroken because I thought, oh, I would love to have been Margot Fonteyn. That was my dream. And of course, that never happened, but I was nervous. But I went to the editor of the Herald and said, would you mind if I wrote a little piece about Margot Fonteyn? And I thought he'd say no. But he said, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, why not? And so I did about 350 words. And it was in a tiny little sort of piece in about, I don't know, page 12 in the Sydney Morning Herald. I was so pleased with myself, but also sort of worried about, you know, Fonteyn going. And that's how it all began. That's how my dance writing began. And from then on, I interviewed many, many people, many choreographers, dancers, designers, all around different places in the world, New York, Paris, London, but mainly here, of course. And I became that dance writer, not the dance critic, as Jill Sykes, but the dance writer for the Herald. And I did that for, I don't know, at least 10 years. I loved it, and I saved every interview I did. I saved it on a tape. We don't have tapes now. Like, but in those days, you had to have a tape, right? A little funny little machine. And I kept them all, and I wrote everything. I transcribed them all. And so that was the basis for my book, and I've known so many people and spoke to so many people. It was very, very helpful. That's how it began, but really my passion for ballet began a long time before that. It started when I was eight. So my mother was what they called a radio announcer in Dunedin, New Zealand, and she talked to, she had a sort of women's day, women's hour. Because, you know, women didn't do anything else to do women's art, right? But she interviewed some dancers from the Borovansky Ballet who came, you know, from Australia many times to New Zealand. And one day she took me, this eight-year-old, into the studio, and after her, she'd spoken to them, I spoke to them, and I said in a tiny little voice, I'm going to be a ballet dancer. I want to be a ballet dancer one day. And they said, oh, well, we hope you are. Obviously thinking she'll never do that, you know. So that sort of happened, and also my mother, being a media person of the day, took me to the His Majesty's Theatre, or Her Majesty's Theatre it was, and I found paradise there. I found, this is where I belong, you know, like the curtain, the red velvet curtain went up, and you know, the designs, and the costumes, and the music, Tchaikovsky, and whatever, and of course the dances. I was just so, like, I found, we're at my home. And so from then on, I decided I'd be a ballet dancer myself. Definitely I'd be Margot Fonteyn. Now, that didn't work out very well. So I turned to writing at the Australian Financial Review and the Sydney Morning Herald. And after my two daughters were born, I went back into ballet classes when I was much older. And I danced with the girls and boys of 12 or 13. But I just had to go back and learn my ballet steps, which I did for many years. In fact, I still do ballet classes. I must be the oldest ballet student in the world. Don't worry, this is not all my speech. This is just some... So I left the Herald in 2008, and I thought it might take 2 years to write this book. I imagined, after 2 years, I could go to Paris for a year, and I'd take my dog, Molly, and we would go to restaurants, as you can take dogs anywhere in Paris. That plan fell straight on its face. It could never happen. So instead, I spent the first year after the Herald writing as a freelancer because I miss being a journalist so much. It's really hard after 30 years to give up journalism. So I did freelancing so I could feel sort of safe. It was, and then later on, a year after that, I spent a lot of time establishing a website called Dance Lines, and I wrote a chapter for the Australian Ballet's 50th anniversary. And then finally, you see, procrastination was my middle name, really. I just wasn't getting onto the book. But time was up. I had to do some research. But first I had to get a publisher. Now, that wasn't easy, and I think this is important because in Australia, it's very hard to convince publishers to publish a book on a performing arts. Like, everybody that we went to, my agent and myself, said, yeah, we love the idea, love it. And then the marketing team would come zooming in and saying, no, we'll never be able to sell it, can't sell it, you know? So I had lots of tears, lots of, you know, disappointments. And finally I found this publisher I have, which you'll see there, who actually understood what I was trying to do. He understood the theme of my book, the themes of my book. And we began to write it. So it took even longer to write than I thought. It was not 2 years, it was 8 years. 8 years, the computer. So my plan all along was to avoid too much chronology but focus on what's happening backstage in the world of the Australian ballet and contemporary dance, and more importantly, what was actually happening in Australia through the decades of the 20th century. So then, how to begin? Well, you know, ballet started in the courts of Italy and France, and so Australia came very late, you know, to become part of, you know, have ballet, real ballet. Although dancers toured to Australia in the 19th century, they were sometimes promoted as ballerinas, but most of them knew more about burlesque dancing, or toe dancing, or deportment, and ballet. They weren't taught ballet, they didn't know anything, even the people who came from abroad. So I began the story in 1913 when Adelaine Genet, a ballerina billed as the world's greatest dancer, arrived in Sydney. And it's interesting that she asked her host when she could see the dances of the indigenous people. It seemed like a good idea because she'd just come from stopping Hawaii on her journey by ship to Australia. And she'd watched the Polynesians dancing the hula. So why wouldn't she see the Aboriginal dances? Well, that never happened. They wouldn't allow that to happen. No, that doesn't, you know, we can't tell you anything about that. I could not believe, you know, that happened. But anyway, her question, can I see the Aboriginal dances, remained unanswered. And her biographer, Genet's biographer, described her disappointment when he wrote, it was one of the few regrets of an otherwise perfect visit that she never witnessed a corroboree. Well, it's 1913, that's how we were in those days. So Genet's tour was followed by two visits by the very famous Anna Pavlova, first in 1926 and 1929. Her manager was her partner, not her husband, and he pushed her to travel around the world non-stop to earn more and more money for him and for her. People adored her, and what they most liked was the Dying Swan solo, which you probably know about, you've probably seen it. People loved it. She did it everywhere, but she got more and more tired, more and more upset. She was really, really, really stressed. The Australian media wrote ridiculous articles about her charming glow, her poetic movement of enchanting grace, and glowing womanhood. You know, they didn't know what they were talking about. So her team of dancers, many of them Australian, many of English, including one man, asked also to see Aboriginal dance, but he was told that couldn't happen. Never, no, I'm not going to let you have to do that. Instead, they gave him a boomerang. When Pavlova returned in 1929, she danced and travelled with her team right down the coast of Queensland, because the British theatre that they thought they would first be in was undergoing renovations. Their travel was really, really difficult because they get on a train, do a show in one small town, and then after the show, they get on back on the train, sleep in the train, and go to the next little town, and then do it again, and then get back on the train. I mean, this was hell. You know, they had to sleep in the train, which was just slow, until they got to Brisbane. Well, soon after she left Australia for that tour, Pavlova was diagnosed with pleurisy. And at the time, she was in a hotel in The Hague, and she was going to dance there. And it's said that just after midnight on the 23rd of January 1931, she said to her maid, Marguerite, get my swan costume ready. And then she died. I can't, every time I say that, I start crying. And whether she said that or not, I don't know, but what an amazing quote. So many dancers followed Pavlova as they sailed from London. They were also adored, but they also suffered, you know, other problems. Olga Spesitsova came. She was Russian, but she danced in Paris and London. And one night when she was dancing in Sydney, she went into a panic attack. She blanked out. She couldn't stop dancing. She just stopped dancing, and her partner tried to keep her, you know, moving, but she had to leave the stage. She had to leave Australia, and then she went to France and then New York, where she was taken into a hospital, then an asylum, where she was taken to a psychiatric wing of the Bellevue Hospital, and then to the Hudson River Asylum for the Insane. What a terrible title that is. Until she was taken to a rest home for Russians in New York, and she died there in 1991, aged 96, she was probably one of the best dancers, ballet dancers the world has ever seen. And if she'd had the medication that we have now, that wouldn't have happened. She was just probably bipolar or something like that. Instead, she was shuffled into asylums. So my chapter on that is quite long, because, you know, I think because of that awful problem she had, you know, in Sydney, where she just fell over, she just stopped. That was really, really part of Australian ballet history that hasn't really properly been told. So after that, the Ballet Russe came. Now, the Ballet Russe was a fake name, you know, it wasn't real. Ballet Russe wasn't from Russia. There were groups of dancers collected in London and sent out by ship from 1936 to 1940. And that really brought ballet in Australia to, you know, a higher level, because the audiences, they became friends with the dancers. They took them to picnics. You know, they took them to parties. They gave them presents. You know, they fell in love. And also, the dancers were very involved with Australian writers, Australian artists. And so that made a big change to ballet in Australia. The tours were, it was like, it was very difficult. It was run, the person who called himself the impresario was called Colonel de Basil, which is quite a fake name in itself. And the tours were managed by the directors of J.C. Williamson, a theatrical agency. But this was a time when many of those dancers couldn't return to Europe at all, because Hitler had overtaken, you know, the countries that they were born in, like the Czechoslovakia. Just a note on what it was like for the dancers. In 1938, they had to sail from London, and it was a time when, this is how I felt for the young dancers. I felt for them about this because my own dancer left, my own daughter left to go to Royal Ballet School when she was just turned 16, and we both cried our eyes out at Heathrow and back again. And so at that time, these women, these young women, were really upset, really hurt. So this 1938 tour, they went on a a boat called the Malodja, and I'm just going to read something from this chapter. It creaked and trembled as prepared to sail from Southampton on the first leg of its journey to Australia. Richard Kelly wept as she stood on the deck, looking down at the wharf where her mother waved goodbye. She wouldn't see her again for 9 months. How was she going to survive in Australia, a place that she knew nothing about? All she knew was the incredibly long time it took to get there, 5 weeks on a ship. Brigitte, the newest recruit in the travelling company, had plastered her brand new cabin trunk with labels of her stage name, Maria Sanina. All these dancers took Russian names, you know, to make them look real. they were either Canadian or English. So standing near to Brigitte on the deck was a woman, the mother of another young dancer on the tour, Anna, her name was. She was a stoic, a diehard ballet mother called. And she said to Brigitte, "Why you cry?" A particularly rash and nasty question, considering her own daughter always travelled with her own mother. Brigitte was one of the young dancers, four young dancers on board. Three of them, including Brigitte, were 17 years old, and the fourth girl, Rosemary Devison, 16. These four, known as the babies for their elders, by their elders, sailed without their mothers or any other relative to support them. Their long letters home revealed their homesickness, as they told their mothers anything about what's happening, any gossip or their disappointments. And really, the people that managed these people, the principals in these companies, would say things like, you know, "Rosemary, you're too fat. You'll have to stop. We can't put you in that ballet." I mean, it's terrible. I don't know how they survived. I'm thinking about my own daughter. You know, the way that we're cared for in London, you know, in the 1990s and beyond. To be told you're too fat, you're going to have to go home or something like that. It's shocking. So that's another cheery moment for me. So also, at that time, coming from London to Australia was very, very, very frightening and dangerous. You know, the 2 days after World War II was declared, the German submarine torpedoed a British transatlantic passenger liner, the SS Alburnia. More than 120 civilians and crew lost their lives in November 1939. The passenger ship Simon Beauvoir struck a German mine and sank in the North Sea with a loss of 86 passengers, including children and babies. Hours before that disaster happened, the ship carrying the dancers from London sailed from the port of Tilbury en route for Australia. So you could see, like, you know, like it was terrifying, really. And of course, when they got here, they knew that, you know, that the war was on, finally the war was on, and they wouldn't be able to go home, particularly if they were Czech or some other, you know, from some other country. So two of the people that either came back or stayed there were Helene Cursiver, who set up her first ballet company in Australia called the Cursiver Ballet. She was with the Ballet Russe. And the second was Edward Borovansky, who couldn't go back to the Czech Republic. So he founded his own company here in Melbourne. And because, you know, in Australia we all shorten our names, you know, I'm Val, I hate that, don't call me Val, whatever. They called him Borro. So Borro. He was always known then as Borro. And he set up his company, which lasted 2 decades. Borro was like, he was very important. And he was really the backbone of what happened later to become part of the Australian Ballet. If it hadn't been for Borovansky, I don't think there would have been an Australian Ballet company. But he was quite nasty as well. I just want to read you a couple of quotes about him. One dancer said he would stand in the auditorium and shout, "You look like an overboiled macaroni." He would often reduce his dancers to tears. It was his belief that Australians, although talented, were lazy, undisciplined, and had no tradition of ballet, and that no professional company would survive without bullying. We can't do that now. We cannot do that anymore. But poor Borovansky, poor Borro. Eventually he had to stop his company. It was J.C. Williamson, who was his supporter, didn't want to do that anymore. They got more money out of musicals at the time. So that all ended. That wasn't the only problem that he had. One of my things that I was most interested in was the actual connection that Australia had culturally to England. And I found in London during some research that the British Council archives were in a library there, and I was stunned to find out exactly what they were saying. The British Council was trying to keep Australia close to Britain and not close to America and Hollywood and all the things that, you know, was happening at the time. So these letters from the British Council came from the Secretary General to people in Australia, their representatives in Australia. And if one of the letters said, "The Council's first approaches in Australia should be tactful. Any suggestion that the Council regarded Australia as somewhat uneducated nephew in need of enlightenment would naturally be unfortunate." They also said, "Australia is very isolated. It has no sort of cultural background. Australia wants to remain British and portray British influences in the Pacific, but she needs help in doing so." That's how we were. That was the culture of Australia at the time, like Britain. And then in 1945, there was a letter, "Australia is ballet mad. We should be prepared as soon as transport conditions allow to send out a really good company." And that turned out to be the Ballet Rambert, which is a London company. They came out. They also, various theatre companies came, orchestras, British exhibitions. Sir Laurence Olivier came out with his wife. And I got a quote from Simon Goldwyn, not directly from Simon Goldwyn, who had a question to Olivia. He said, "Why are you, the greatest actor in the world, taking a touring company to Australia of all places?" So that was the end of Borovansky, right? So he died in 1959. He tried so hard. In the beginning, when I was writing about him, I thought, Borrow, you know. But now I think, you know, he was a hero. I was really upset for what happened to him. And he died so young as well. So at the time, a group of English, former English dancers thought, well, we need to get a new company, and it needs to be a British company. So the British thing didn't stop at that time. And they sorted out various ways of getting a British dancer or British choreographer to come to Australia and set up and take over the Borovansky Ballet just for a couple of years, just after Borrow died. And that was Peggy Van Praagh, who was a Londoner. She was a very, very talented dancer and a really, really good teacher. But the way she began to be the foundation director of the Australian Ballet was really through politics, for the politics came into the ballet at that time. And that included Nugget Coombs, who was the secretary of the bank, wasn't he? Secretary of the bank?
Yes, the secretary.
And then he got in touch with the Prime Minister, Menzies, and he got in touch with the Treasurer, Harold Holt, and together with J.C. Williamson's and the Australian Theatre Book Trust, they all got together and they agreed that Peggy Van Praagh would be the right person to work with Borovansky and then to become the director of the Australian Ballet. And the Australian dancers, many of them were in the first company, they were mainly from Borovansky, and they were Aussies. And then Peggy comes in, she goes, "Nutter, darling, darling, darling," and she called them all by their surnames, you know. John, not John, okay, Wilson, Wilson, what are you doing, what are you doing? Took a long time for her to actually be loved by the dancers. She turned out to be a great dancer, and she tried really, really hard to put on Australian ballet. So one of them was Melbourne Cup, which was a disaster. You could never do that now, Melbourne Cup. Like the girls would have... I think the girls were the horses and the men were the jockeys or something, the other way around. Like, you could never do that. anyway, that was very funny. So that's how the Australian Ballet began, 1962. And she had real problems then, Prague. She always wanted to get married, she wanted a partner, she never found the right man. But also, she didn't have a ballet body, her hips didn't turn out. So she had, by the time she was in Australia, she had 12 surgeries for her hips. Now, in those days, it's not like having surgery for your hips now, right? Those days, it was brutal. And so she used to have to dance direct, holding a pole. Eventually, it was a sort of inevitable thing. The board of the Australian Ballet decided that they wanted to get rid of her. And why? It's because they thought that Robert Houghton would be a more, better person, He was very famous, big career in London. So they took in Houghton. And Houghton's... A little bit about what Houghton looked like. He liked to pose for a photo wearing a snakeskin print shirt, unbuttoned to his midriff, two gold chains nestled in his chest here, and a cigarette dangling in his fingers. After the photographer took a shot for, say, the Australian Women's Weekly, the reporter wanted to know if Houghton was tired of all the media interest he attracted. And he replied, "It's part of my job, isn't it?" Yes, it was, but for Houghton, this is me talking, chatting with the press wasn't just a job. He loved to bask in the limelight. Never more than the year of 1979, when he took role as artistic director of the Adelaide Festival of the Arts. It was in that time the last gasp of Australians' long love affair with British culture, because what was happening in Australia then was, emerging artists, filmmakers, writers, playwrights, all on a parallel path. When Gough Whitlam said on the 13th of November 1972, he made his famous "It's Time" speech at the Blacktown Civic Centre. "It's time for a new team, a new programme, a new drive for equality of opportunities. It's time to create new opportunities for Australians, time for a new vision of what we can achieve and create new opportunities for the generation of our nation and the region in which we live." I mean, I think probably some of you may remember that speech, which was fantastic. Unfortunately, Gough didn't last so very long. But at that time, it was David Williamson's Don Party. There were so many different films. John Bell and Ken Haller opened the Nimrod Theatre, and two-thirds of the 90 plays staged at the Nimrod in its first 7 years were Australian plays. So the renaissance of the Australian film industry began even earlier, I don't know if you remember these movies, like The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, My Brilliant Career, Newsfront, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Inbreak of Moran, Gallipoli, and The Year of Living Dangerously. So finally, Australian Ballet kind of got into that system as well, and they tried really hard to catch up. But ballet was probably the last performing arts or orchestra or whatever to do that. And it wasn't until Graham Murphy took over the Sydney Dance Company as a director and also choreographed for the Australian Ballet that Australian works came back. So his works were very much based on Australian areas, Australian people, Australian wherever, beaches. And he's still doing that. Like next year he's doing a ballet called The Happy Prince, but instead of the end coming to somewhere in paradise, the end is going to end up on Bondi Beach. I don't know if that's really going to work, but that's him. He also choreographed an amazing Nutcracker, which was really a history of ballet in Australia, who came out from Russia, what happened next, what happened in the war. For me, that's a masterpiece that he did. Go and see it if you haven't seen it yet, but I hope it'll be back soon. So Murphy worked with Kristen Fredrickson, who was a man I loved so much. He was a designer, and they had so much in common. So they did a new Swan Lake, they did a new Sleeping Beauty, they did a new Nutcracker together. And just a little quote: "Opposites attract. Also, it seemed when the introvert Fredrickson met the extrovert Graham Murphy, Fredrickson described himself as a hermit, but only a semi-hermit, as he often left his King's Cross home. He had to, because the theatre world is a collaborative business. And Fredrickson liked the company of others, although his anguished facial experience sometimes said otherwise. Murphy told me that Fredrickson was always full of angst. Fredrickson, meanwhile, told me Murphy was an imp, not a nice pixie, an imp. He's a puck. I marvel at his energy. Graham has heart, an enormous amount of romanticism and passion. So that's how that collaboration works so brilliantly until finally Fredrickson died when he was quite young. But Graham's still going. Like, he's going strong. Even though he was ill last year, he's really well. So I think I didn't really know how to finish my book. You know, like, how do you finish a book? It's an ongoing thing. You know, it's an ongoing story of ballet in Australia. If I'd known that David McAllister was about to retire as artistic director, he didn't tell me at the time, I didn't do that. I would have done that. And David's a really very strong director. He's been there 20 years. And we're all hoping that there's going to be another great director. We don't know who it is. So instead of doing that, I didn't know about that, I just wrote some little snippets of different things that I've been at, what I've been, when I've been in Paris, when I've been in New York, and when I finally, the final person I interviewed was Stephen Page, who was the director for many years, and still is, of the Bangarra Dance Company. So all that time when dancers wanted to see Aboriginal dance, and they couldn't, now then, Bangarra collaborated with the Australian Ballet, and that would actually happen as well in the ballet called The Rites in Paris. And I thought, why, I was there because my daughter was still in the company. And I thought, this is the beginning and the end of the story. Like, from no Indigenous people to the collaboration of ballet and Aboriginal dance, really. And I just thought, and also it was in Paris, so that's one of the places where ballet really began. So that's how I ended the book. So that's my story.
Many thanks to Valerie Lawson. As I said, we've got copies of the book, and I'm sure the author will be happy to sign them. Dancing Under the Southern Skies, A History of Ballet in Australia, which has just come out this year. So thanks for a comprehensive and lively presentation. So if you just come back up here. As I was listening to you, and then I remembered when I looked at your book earlier, I just wonder about the argument that Australia was a kind of cultural wasteland until the early 1970s, because on my calculation, 3/4 of your book occurs before 1970, so something must have been happening. So, and as you know, the Australian ballet starts in the, I think you said the late 60s, the early 60s, 62, right? So, to what extent was the development of the 70s just further development? Because obviously, a lot was happening from your own research in the early years, particularly into the 20th century.
Well, before the Australian Ballet began, there was a ballet company in Perth, West Australian Ballet. There was also a ballet company in Brisbane. So, you know, we weren't alone to the Australian Ballet. That was just the first national company we had. There was also very good teachers at that time, like from the 50s through the 70s, where there were members of the Royal Academy of Dance, and they taught very well. They got dancers to be so good that they could go, but then they had to go back to London to get a job, mostly, you know. So there was good ballet in Australia. It just wasn't really, you know, out there front and centre. Sure.
You mentioned the, you were in the library, I think it was, for the British Council. In the archives, and you talked about this letter where they said in 1945 that Australia was ballet mad.
Yeah.
What evidence did they have of that? Can I just ask you a follow-up too? I didn't realise, forgive my ignorance about Hay and Anna Pavlova, what the heck was she doing in Hay? How many?
The Hague.
Oh, sorry.
She was on tour.
Oh, the Hague play. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The Hague. Sorry. Den Haag.
Yeah.
Well, what was the first question? Sorry.
The evidence that Australia.
Oh, they had the evidence because they, the British Council had representatives in Sydney and Melbourne, and so they knew all about the ballet routes and how, you know, Australian people were so intrigued by that, and Borovensky. That's how they knew. So that's why we were ballet mad. But they wanted to put something from Britain, you know, which would be better because, you know, the Borovensky ballet was quite, you know, not good. In their respect, in their respect, what they thought.
We'll go here.
Right.
Then we'll go
here.
I think you've written a really important book about our cultural history. My question is about the ballet routes, and you mentioned the British Council reaction. What impact do you think that the ballet routes had in terms of cutting the umbilical cord with another country?
Well, I mean, in a way, the Australians loved those tours, you know. That was the most exciting thing they'd ever seen. Also, sometimes the dance, the ballets were designed by Australian artists or even Australian musicians. I don't know. It's the Ballet Russe was really a fake company in my view, because the dancers were collected in London, or they come from the United States or Germany or anywhere, you know. So, but it did elevate ballet, you know, as a performing arts. Mm.
There's a question down there. Yeah. Come on.
Thank you. With Australia becoming more and more multicultural, how do you see Australian attitude or appreciation to classical ballet in the last 30 or 40 years?
Could you just repeat that?
The question was the impact of multiculturalism in Australia on Australian ballet in the last 30 to 40 years.
Okay, well, now they have Aboriginal dancers in the company itself. The Australian Ballet is working with Bangarra. We also, like, the dancers are swapped. So, for example, in the current Ballet of Nutcracker, there's a Danish dancer there. You know, they swap, you know, and they send one of their own dancers to Denmark. You know. Many of the dancers are from Asia. Two of the best dancers are actually from China. So, but normally, the Australian Ballet will take Australian dancers that trained at the Australian Ballet School. Whereas if you're in London or Berlin or Stuttgart or New York, they can come from anywhere. It's a global world now. You don't have to just say, oh, we only take them. And I think that should be lifted a little bit. But it's hard to get a visa to be a dancer in Australia, so I tend to take the school graduates. Mm.
While we're on that theme, you mentioned Mao's Last Dancer in your book.
Yeah.
So you might tell us a bit about how he fits in?
Well, he was a principal dancer at the Houston Ballet, and you may have seen a film about that. And then he came and joined the Australian Ballet. He's a brilliant dancer. And he just had enough. He decided he'd retire from that, and he became he went into the financial world. But he got tired of that as well, and then he's so charismatic, he's so brilliant at getting money, he makes people cry when he does his speeches, he became the next artistic director of the Queensland Ballet, and he's a really good director, right? He's very good at money making, and you know, the Queensland Ballet has changed very different, you know, in a big way. People think that he might take up the job of the Australian Ballet directorship, but he keeps saying, no, I won't, but I'm not sure that he won't, really. But, yeah, like, I used to run tours, Renaissance tours, with dancers or people that love ballet, and I remember the day we went up to Queensland Ballet, and he was so generous to me and the tour members that they almost fell over with sort of Oh, look, I'm standing next to Lee Xuan Xing. Photo, please. He can charm anybody and everybody. So I don't think he's going anywhere, but it'd be interesting to know if he does go to the Australian Ballet. When he first wrote his book, I did a review, and the review was in the Sydney Morning Herald, and I was in London at the time looking after my daughter, and I had a phone call at 3 a.m. I thought, oh my God, somebody's died. It turned out to be him thanking me for the review. I said, Lee, it's 3 a.m. in London. I remember that. But yeah, he's a good man.
Next question,
then. The period that you cover in your book, the physicality, the technique, the style of dancing has changed substantially over that period that you cover. Which directors have had the most impact, and how have they impacted those changes?
You mean the way they dance, what they can do? Do you mean the way that they can dance like that, jump like that, or?
Well, their physicality.
Physicality. Look, you look at articles or photos from, say, the 20s, 30s, 40s. They don't have dances, ballets that we see now. Balanchine, George Balanchine changed all that because the dancers had to be really thin, you know, quite tall, and similar to one another. And so in every decade, a dancer told me, every decade it goes up and up and up, not just literally, but, you know, you have to be better and better and better, which is really hard, especially for women and men that don't have that body. And now, you know, everybody's expected to take their leg, the girls are supposed to take their leg up to there, like that. Started with Sylvie Guillen, a famous French dancer, and really she had hips that just open up, and so, you know, I wish I had those hips, just goes like up, like that. And then the men, if you could ever see the Bolshoi Ballet, they can jump, and they just sort of hang up in the air, like they're just amazing. They, you know, but they wouldn't take people that couldn't do that. So they go and they started it, you know, at school when they're like 8 or something like that, younger. And they train, and if you're no good, they can't do that, their body can't do that, no, out the door. Just really, ballet's a harsh thing.
Question here.
Valerie, thank you for taking us on that incredible journey. The Australian Ballet has achieved world recognition. Who do you think most influenced or turned the ballet around the most to get Australia the recognition it currently has?
Yeah, well, I think apart from Peggy Van Praagh, it would have to be Maina Gielgud. Like, she was shown the door as well. I mean, only David McAllister has never been told to go. And Maina really, she brought in a lot of European direct choreographers, like Yuri Killian, and she, it brightened up quite a lot, so she had a big influence. And David too, David's been like steady as you go, and the choreography, the repertoire is good. And also, the Australian Ballet goes to many places now. They go to China, Thailand, Japan, New York, London, and they usually get quite good reviews. And if you've got a really nasty New York critic, which can happen, but yeah, I think that David and Maina made it what it is today.
Valerie, I've got a soft spot in Tasmania, but I think Graham Murphy originates from Tasmania. And a long time ago, I had a Tasmanian student who wanted to be a ballerina but never would become one, but she'd done some lessons, and she was mad about Graham Murphy, partly because he was from Tassie. Tell us a bit more about Graham, because it is unusual for someone to come from that little Apple Isle and make such a mark on a creative art as he's done. Can you give us a good look at how Graham got where he got and where he came from?
Well, his parents were very sort of supportive of him. Now, a lot of parents, even today, say we don't want our boy to go to a dance company, dance school. But they looked after him. They took him to the only really good dance teacher in Tasmania. And they take him to, you know, take it like might take 4 hours to get there and get back again. And then eventually he went to Melbourne, where he met Fredrickson, and he did a lot of work there. And then he's a very good choreographer. That's when he went to the Sydney Dance Company. He wasn't the first director there, but the board was, you know, they thought he was fantastic. He's very charismatic. And so, yeah, he did some wonderful things at the Sydney Dance Company. Eventually he left because he wasn't getting the funding from the government that he needed. But I don't know, I think that kind of line, it depends a lot on the family. They either say, no, we're not going to go to a dance class, or we'll do everything we can, all out. And he had that, but he had the... Like, Helpman loved him dance, to watch him dance. He was a good, very good dancer. So he was good... He was lucky. You've got to be lucky in ballet. And he was lucky with his parents and with his teachers, and then in the company.
And might tell us just a bit more about Helpman, who I guess is one of the best known to those of us who are not on the stage.
Well, Helpman, you know, he was a good choice to bring him back to Australia, because he'd been with the Royal Ballet in London for years. But he was, you know, he was an actor as well as a dancer, and he was getting along. He thought, I can't do this for very long. So he came back to Australia, and he did some really good works, you know, like one of them was The Merry Widow. Well, he had another choreographer for that, but he did some great works, and people liked him. He was funny, you know, he was always out there with a microphone. He was always there to promote himself. And then, you know, right at the end, he was still working, right in 1986, he was still doing some work there. And Checkmate, he was the Red King. I don't know if anybody remembers that ballet. And, he turned up every day, you know, did his bit, and then one day didn't turn up, he just died in Sydney. But, you know, the interesting thing about him is that I would love to have met his partner. His partner, they lived in Mossman together. And that man, he never told anybody ever anything about Helpman. So there's three Helpman books, biographies that are done. None of them say anything about his personal life.
So we're getting close to the end. Have I missed anyone? I haven't. So tell us, I think this is book number 4. Mm-hmm. Will there be a book number 5? And if there is, what might that be?
That's a good question. Look, I don't know. I've had ever since I finished the book, I think about it every day, every evening. What am I going to do next? I can't. Because once you do that for 8 years, you think I'm lost. You feel in limbo. I've thought about a memoir because being a female journalist in the 70s is just so different. There were so few women at the Financial Review. And I think I've got so many funny stories from being one of those first women, because my late husband, Victor Carroll, was the editor-in-chief of the Financial Review, and he was a feminist, really. I mean, he brought in more women than we had ever had there, the Financial Review, and he continued that as the editor-in-chief of the Sydney Morning Herald. But throughout those years, those 30 years at Fairfax, there are so many funny stories, but I would be frightened of defamation. But I have to be very careful, get a lawyer. But I think being a woman in those days is just so nice. I mean, it was Me Too thing. I would have been one of those Me Too people, but of course, you just ignored it. What happened, you know? But it was so much fun as well. There was a lot of drinking. Yes, and there was lots of fun. And one of the editors used to take us to the pub over the road, Ultimo, and say, right, it's champagne time, off we go. Well, you don't get that now. Also, James Fairfax was the chairman in the golden years, and he just let everybody do what they want to do in the journal, in the newsroom, whereas his predecessor, Sir Warwick Fairfax, was really not like, no. He just stopped things if he didn't like it. He didn't like any article about Vietnam, about the war. We shouldn't have been involved in Vietnam, but anybody wrote anything about that, it would just be cut. Whereas James was just, it's your newsroom, you do it.
Since you worried about defaming the living, what about the dead?
Well, you see, the dead have daughters and children, yeah. Peter Wright, a wonderful choreographer in London, he did a book and he just told the truth. You know, like Sylvie Williams, nasty, she was a bitch, things like that. The book had to be scrapped and redone. So, you know, like, I'm still quite keen to do it, partly, I think, because, you know, Victor died, my husband died in April, and I want my daughters to know what it was like in those days beforehand.
Yes, Jacqueline?
I was going to ask you, would you dig, given your, you know, fabulous skills as a journalist and covering so many areas, why don't you dig more into Robert Heltman? It was a very interesting period.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, his sexual desire, you know, like I don't really want to go that way, you know, like he just had so many men, and I don't want to, look, there's already 3 biographies, and they, you know, these books about people like Heltman or other dancers or choreographers, they don't sell very well either. I'd like to do a book that a very important person that everyone knows, a biography that I must have that book. But, you know, I did think about doing a biography of Ella Fitzgerald, who's one of my favourite singers ever. I thought, yeah, that would mean about 3 years in the United States. We can't do that. So I don't know. I'll let you know in a year.
Many thanks. And when you do, you must come back here again. So, but for tonight, congratulations on Dancing Under the Southern Skies, the history of ballet in Australia. I'm sure the author would be happy to sign that book. And for tonight, many thanks for a lively presentation. And a few of us are off to ballet class, which I'll be participating in soon. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.